Thanks, everyone. So essentially, what I'm going to be chatting about today is kind of a tendency within anarchism. You know, we've spoken a lot of today and yesterday as well, the different kind of strands within anarchism. And there's a tendency that kind of emerged really in the 70s and 80s, primarily in Greece and in Italy, known as insurrectionary anarchism. And insurrectionary practices have always been part of anarchist history. We can see this all the way back to Bakunin, but really became in the kind of 1980s a kind of ideological formation when people actually started talking about insurrectionalism. So I'm interested in that primarily from an organizing perspective. So I'm interested in how we as anarchists can sharpen our skills in order to attack kind of forces of oppression and that which prevents our liberation. So I'm interested from an organizational point of view, but also in a question of desire and feelings. You know, we want to organize in ways that also make us feel great and feel nice and feel joyful. So these are kind of things that I'm interested in when thinking about this question of organization. So just to give a kind of an outline, I'm going to run through the context of what I'm going to be talking about, specifically the key insurrectional foundational thinker, Alfredo Bonanno, who's an Italian writer. We'll talk about him in a second. Then his critique of work. The critique that he has of work under capitalism is kind of foundational to his critique of what he calls formal organizing, where precisely what's problematic with work under capitalism reproduces itself as political work, what we think of as organizing work or activist work. And then, of course, I'm going to talk about revenge and rage because these are kind of central motivating factors for many of us who kind of face an unjust world that many of us feel that we need to kind of bring down. So to begin with the context of Alfredo Bonanno, he's an Italian writer who's still alive today, and he wrote in the 1980s, he started to develop an idea of insurrectionary anarchism. But even before then, he started to write a really interesting text called Armed Joy, 1977. This is a time in Italy when you have the Brigata Rossa, the Red Brigades. And essentially, it was a time when the Italian state was really facing revolutionary upheaval. And so he wrote this text, Armed Joy, which he was sentenced to 18 months in prison. It's a very weird text. It's kind of poetic, kind of polemic, and we'll see kind of some quotes from it. But really, the aim of the text, as it says here, was to show how practice of liberation and destruction can come forth from a joyful logic of struggle. So what I'm going to try to do here is to clarify and elucidate what exactly he was trying to do, and also try to defend and use modern examples and exactly what was going on then. So I'm using kind of an old contextual case to think about modern struggles and modern forms of organizing today. So what exactly is his critique of work? I take it as relatively uncontroversial that play and joy are necessary for human flourishing, yeah? We all kind of want to live in a society where we can play and feel joyful and happy, right? It's kind of uncontroversial. I also take it controversial, at least in this crowd, perhaps, that work is exploitative and capitalism really isn't a lot of fun. Now, of course, we all get holidays and we all get weekends, and, you know, capitalism affords us a lot of opportunities to really enjoy ourselves, but for Bonanno, this isn't true fun. He says that the worker's play is not joy, it is a macabre ritual, an awaiting death, a suspension of work in order to lighten the pressure of violence accumulated during the activity of production. And of course, the critique of leisure time is not being truly leisure time. It's not new. Marx also had this idea that, you know, leisure time is just a time for recuperation to begin the work cycle anew. But for Bonanno, the reason why work is problematic and we don't feel joyful is that because there's no self-determination. Meaningful joy cannot be externally imposed. Now, we can imagine a system, for instance, where doctors give everyone pills and make us all happy, but it seems weird that nobody would actually describe this as, you know, a system we all feel meaningful joy. I think the intuitive idea that Bonanno's getting at here is, of course, that joy and happiness, while it cannot be forced, it has to arise from conditions of autonomy. We have to feel in control of our lives to truly feel happy. We cannot force our own happiness, but our own happiness cannot arise outside conditions of autonomy. So autonomy is a necessary condition in order to feel happiness. So the question is then, if work under capitalism is boring, stultifying, and oppressive, and therefore doesn't produce happiness, and the reason is because we lack autonomy, the obvious question is, can therefore a self-determined work produce joy? The answer for Bonanno is no. And he comes from a tradition of thinkers that are anti-work. Now, for Bonanno, if production is at the root of capitalist exploitation, simply changing the mode of exploitation doesn't change the mode of exploitation. As he says in the text itself, if you paint a cat red, it's still a cat. Of course, reference to kind of communist society. For him, instead, what he wants to move beyond a focus on work, and rather what he proposes, what he will call the non-work aesthetic. And he has a number of critiques against work, and I want to kind of clarify one of the critiques, which I'll call the critique of dehumanization, which becomes really foundational in the critique of organizing that I'll chat about in a second. And the critique of dehumanization goes something like this. I'll give an example. So I'm going to run through the kind of critique, and then I'll give an example to kind of clarify it. So what the idea is, central to commodity production is the principle of exchange. Of course, for me to buy, for me to be able to purchase this glass of water for a certain commodity of lumber or what have you, we have to reduce these objects to a certain monetary value. So they become exchangeable according to a common denominator. Of course, capital functions to actually do this in contemporary society. Now, the idea behind commodity value or the exchange value is that it requires quantification of irreducible objects. So now all of a sudden, a certain quantity of lumber is equal to a number of cappuccinos in Starbucks or what have you, right? So certain things that are not the same and are not measurable and already not at all similar become similar under capitalism because they become reduced to a certain monetary value. Now what this requires, therefore, is a quantification of objects. And a quantification of life is a form of dehumanization. So we can understand why self-determined work is not the same thing, would be self-determined dehumanization because work requires quantification. Now, the example to kind of make this clear comes from James Scott. And I think it's quite an interesting example. James Scott uses the example of early modern scientific practices of scientific forestry to demonstrate how the state's fiscal concerns to generate capital from timber entailed the reduction of diverse and chaotic old-growth forests. What we see is, this kind of already free, liberated forest, hasn't been kind of encroached upon, in order to produce a controlled, quantifiable, commodified forest, which can be administered. This is what we see on the right side, the scientific forest. Now, what we see here is that both the reduction of elements in order to be manipulated, in order to produce profit, entail both the kind of symmetry between a bureaucratic state logic, where, we administer control and manipulate in order for the purposes of what have you, and a capitalist logic. And so here, the logic of a commercial logic and a state bureaucratic logic becomes synonymous in practice of scientific forestry. And what I want to argue is that the same thing happens to workers under capitalism, the same thing happens to all of us. Capital dehumanizes us because it transforms us into exchangeable commodities, where our life is measurable, quantifiable, according to a wage or a salary. And of course, our needs are secondary. What's really important here is for us to have a wage so that we can reproduce ourselves as labor power, right? So we can reproduce ourselves as workers. So our actual needs for flourishing are only secondary for the purposes of the state to reproduce us as workers with labor power, which can be administered and controlled for the purposes of profit generation. So what's his alternative then? For Bonanno, the alternative is what he calls the non-work aesthetic. Now, the idea is that because he wishes to critique the idea of work as such, he thinks that we cannot look to work as the source of flourishing. Instead, we need to look for play and joy as the way we actually self-actualize as humans. This doesn't mean that work isn't important to create the conditions of flourishing. Of course, we need to build crops or build houses, mow the lawn, what have you. But we don't flourish as individuals during work. Work creates the necessary conditions for flourishing, but we flourish outside of work. We flourish in the sphere of play. Now, in the context of dehumanization, this is really important. So we see that joy is necessary for human flourishing. Okay, we understand that. For Bonanno, what's important about joy is that joy cannot be quantified. Joy is beyond rules. It's spontaneous. It cannot be cataloged. There's something that simply cannot be controlled about joy because it's beyond, therefore, the exchange principle. Precisely the logic of control and quantification behind the exchange principle doesn't extend to the principle of play. Play cannot be controlled. Play cannot be quantified, because otherwise it wouldn't be true play. I mean, it seems really weird to experience meaningful joy during a game where you have tightly set bound of rules. A game, in order to be truly happy for Bonanno, has to somehow go beyond cataloged rules. Of course, we can only come to a common agreement to how we play a game, but to have a really constrained, controlled environment would not be fun. And I think this is kind of the basic intuitive idea that Bonanno's trying to work with. So what this means then, of course, is that because the principle of play goes beyond the principle of exchange, because it goes beyond the idea of control and quantification behind the principle of exchange, individuals who play cannot be dehumanized, because in play we flourish and play cannot be controlled. So what I've spoken about so far is the idea that work under capitalism is dehumanizing precisely because work functions according to the principle of exchange. Behind the principle of exchange is the logic of quantification and control necessary to exchange. We cannot function according to the capitalism cannot function without the notion of administration and manipulation, which is underlying the principle of exchange itself. Now, for Bonanno, this is central to critique and abolish under capitalism. It's not just getting rid of a capitalist system that's important, but precisely the logical quantification, reduction, manipulation that as anarchists we don't want to have. We don't want to be able to manipulate, control, and coerce others' lives so that such that we can quantify them and then we can reduce them to numbers, because of course that's dehumanizing. So for Bonanno, the non-work aesthetic goes beyond that. And what I want to talk about now is how certain forms of political organizing can actually perpetuate precisely that problematic element of work. But before I talk about that, I just want to talk about a question of prefiguration. We're going to hear in a second about prefiguration. But what I just wanted to point out is that what's really interesting about insurrectionary anarchism is that prefiguration, of course, means, and I quite like this quote from a comrade in the Pacific Northwest, Taiki Alfred, who's a Bear Clan Mohawk member. He says that how you fight determines who you will become when the battle is over. Insurrectionary anarchism, of course, believes that we want to live in a world that is playful and joyful. And as such, prefiguratively, that means our struggles should also be playful and joyful, if that's the kind of world we want to create. So we see that the concern with emotions and affect is central to insurrectionary organizing, which I think is very interesting, because often, as anarchists, we talk about prefiguration a lot, but we don't talk about the emotional health of militants, and this is central to insurrectionary anarchism. So what exactly is formal organizing, then? Bonanno makes the comparison of formal organizing to informal organizing. Formal organizing, I'll just kind of run through the list, and I think we all come from different places, so I think everyone has a different idea of what kind of things are. But in the UK, we can imagine Socialist Workers' Party, unions, for instance. Bonanno is also very critical of Brandon spoke about yesterday about the anarcho-syndicalist tradition. He's also very critical of the anarcho-syndicalist tradition of IWW, of workers' unions, anarchists have historically been involved in organizing. These are formal organizations because they function according to the following principles. First of all, they aim towards permanence and self-preservation. So what that means is that even after a particular struggle is ended, they still want to continue. As a result, therefore, they develop according to general ideological principles outside of particular struggles, which then seek application in the field of struggle, and they have principled tactics regardless of particular context. So to give you an example then, in Finland, we heard about how there's mining corporations going on. In the UK, we have fracking projects going on. So a formal organization would be someone like Greenpeace, for instance, or a union who would say, or the Socialist Workers' Party would say, look, we have these principles, here's this fracking project, let's apply our principles to the fracking project, organize the people in the fracking project in order to get rid of whatever the site is, and then after the fracking project, that's great, we have new recruits. But not only says, beware of the language of recruitment. Whenever you hear other anarchists talk about recruitment, they're thinking in the language of numbers and the game of numbers. An informal style of organizing would instead say, okay, there's a fracking site. Let's organize with the people in that fracking community. Let's create an organization there. Once we get rid of the fracking site, that organization's over, and we develop our principles and our tactics outside of the specific context of the struggle. So that means the question of violence, non-violence, disruption, sabotage, whatever, always has to emerge out of the context of a particular struggle. And we cannot have principled arguments. And this is kind of what Katharina was talking about, that informal organizing just doesn't work in this kind of binary of nonviolence violence. It's always a question of context that's really, really important. What is the most effective means to achieve liberation in a specific site of struggle? And once that site of struggle is over, the organization collapses. It no longer exists, and we move on to the next struggle. So what interests me is the question of hierarchical control that's really central in formal organizations. Now, anarchist theory has traditionally been very skeptical of hierarchical control, but for Bonanno, even anarcho-syndicalist styles of organizing manifest this. He says revolutionary organizations dream of orderly revolutions, neatly drawn up principles, anarchy without turbulence. If things take a different turn, they start screaming provocation, yelling loud enough for the police to hear them. And I think this is a very interesting idea here. And what I want to give as an example of this is precisely the illustration of the Black Bloc. Now, the Black Bloc, of course, we heard about the tactic where, you know, we dress in black to engage in a kind of mobile bloc. The Black Bloc functions according to self-determined principles, right? So if I want to engage in military, if I want to engage in a confrontation with the police, if I want to attack bank windows, if I want to smash, fascists, the Bloc provides me anonymity because of the uniform aesthetic, but also preservation, because there's a kind of respectful diversity of tactics within the Bloc and a camaraderie among people that use Black Bloc tactics. Now, we see the way that certain unions, and here I have a list of really great quotes from Susan George, I think really illustrates my point, is that the Black Bloc are unmanageable idiots. They're vandals, they're criminals, there's no unity because of them, and we need disciplined activism. I think what this really illustrates is that these organizations who don't think of Black Bloc tactics in a specific context, you know, is Black Bloc tactics useful, is it not useful in this kind of event, in this kind of situation, they say, no, we always need nonviolence, we always need disciplined activism. And what this shows us is that, of course, that formal organizations, given that they aim towards permanence and preservation, and because they have party platforms and set kind of ideological principles, that cannot analyze specific sites of struggles in their particularity and specificity, therefore are not connected to particular movements in their particularity. What this means then is when participants act according to their own autonomy, according to their own self-determined principles, these organizations are very quick to exclude themselves from them. They're very quick to reject these elements that disavow party lines. What this means, therefore, is we see how hierarchy is really important here in the example of the Black Bloc. And I think this really illustrates Bonanno's point. Of course, the Black Bloc was not really a prevalent tactic when he was writing, but I think the modern phenomenon is the same kind of idea that he's getting at, that organizations that strive towards permanence are quick to disconnect themselves with elements that refuse organizational control. So here, what I want to talk about, of course, is the logic of quantification. What's behind this precise principle of hierarchical control is the idea of quantification. When people regain their power in the streets, when we reclaim what is officially what ought to be ours and what is in fact ours, our power of our own lives, we may do so in ways that are contradictory to formal organizational platforms and to certain ideological principles. This is dangerous to organizations that want to achieve permanence. And as such, the strengthening of a political program requires controlling the masses such that they follow said political program. Now, in the context of political organization, this is very problematic because it's not so much a question of strength in numbers. Of course, we need to spread anarchy. We need to spread cultures of resistance. The problem is the importance of control, which is central to capitalist exchange, which functions according to these union organizations, which functions according to parties. Hierarchical organizations most efficiently increase quantity while removing variable differences, dangerous excesses, and non-quantifiable elements. As such, they use the principle of exchange, precisely the idea of needing to control their membership base, needing to control their recruits, needing to control their party participants, and as such, they impose a model that reproduces the very logic of production, the very logic of control which is behind quantification, thus comes about again in organizational work and political work. So what exactly is our alternative then? First of all, we say that formal organizations do not provide a means for flourishing during struggle. So this means that politics becomes really boring. As Bonanno says, people are tired of meetings, they're tired of the classic pointless marches. They prefer to make love, smoke, listen to music, go for walks, sleep, laugh, play, kill policemen, lame journalists, kill judges, blow up barracks. Right, the idea, he's being quite polemical, but the idea, of course, is that we all have, you know, examples of really boring politics where we just don't feel quite alive. We go to marches, we leave quite bored. The idea is that we don't flourish during these struggles. And people who are concerned with prefigurative politics, concerned with struggles that self-actualize themselves, need to be really concerned about what it means to go to demos where we feel bored and we don't feel alive during these demos. Secondly, formal organizations dehumanize us. When we only have value and symbolic value as a unit of political power, where we only function to legitimize a certain party platform, of course, this erases and flattens out all our differences. The precise importance of anarchist theorizing is putting, in many ways, the individual at the heart of thought, right? Of course, the individual and collective is always in tension with anarchist thought, but when we no longer count as individuals, where our unique differences and what makes us kind of, you know, individual people, and autonomous individuals as at the heart of organizing, we become dehumanized because we only count as units of political power. And third of all, formal organizations are not revolutionary. The idea, of course, is that they use discourse which is revolutionary, but by using the logic of capitalism, by using the logic of control and quantification, they actually just reproduce the mechanisms of capitalism under a veneer of revolutionary legitimacy. So what are the alternatives? First of all, one is anti-hierarchy. We have to give up the belief that struggles can be administered, controlled, or pre-planned. This doesn't, of course, mean that we cannot organize, but I think there's something going on here which is very similar to what George is talking about the Eros effect. We cannot determine the Eros effect. It just will come about. An insurrection is something that cannot be pre-planned. And when things go the wrong way, they can go bad ways, they can be good ways, but we always have to be ready for this. Second of all is the non-delegation of struggle. And I think this is a very interesting and important point. When attacking forces of oppression, when fighting the police, when fighting institutions of oppression, individuals realize themselves as human beings because we need to do so joyfully. Now, because only I can feel happiness for myself and nobody else can feel happiness for me, therefore a leader of an organization cannot feel happiness in my place. So what we see here and what's really important here is the idea that another person cannot represent my emotions. Only I can feel my emotions for me. And I'm going to conclude here with a point about revenge. So we often talk about emotional rationality as being really important. The idea that we should engage political injustice both for reasons that it's unjust, but also because we feel angry, and rightfully so. And revenge is a necessary destructive force. It's really important. But for Bonanno, it risks co-optation. And I'll conclude on this point. For Bonanno, the difference between joy and revenge is that joy cannot be co-opted, whereas revenge can. And we can see the distinction here when we think about the target of revenge. Now, for instance, if I have a boss who's exploiting me, the target of my revenge is located outside myself. Another person can kill my boss, and therefore I may feel kind of satisfied. My revenge is kind of satiated or sated. But this, I may or may not be satisfied. It's not really clear. But the target of one's joy is always oneself, right? The target of joy is not, it can be located outside the self, but it necessarily includes the self. And as such, other members, other comrades, other workers may be part of the conditions for my realization of joy, but I have to be included in that realization. And as such, other people cannot participate in my struggle of liberation without me. And so when we struggle in joyful ways, therefore, our joy cannot be co-opted. But when we struggle according to the motivations of revenge, yes, the revenge can be co-opted because revenge is always located outside the self. And that's why he thinks that we should actually substitute joy for feelings of revenge. And because joy is a scary principle that is beyond the logic of control and quantification, I'll end with a quote from Bonanno in that this, in the struggle against capital, play is not a pastime, but an active weapon. Thanks.